Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Kia ora koutou katoa, welcome to Red Alert Radio with me, Priyanka Radhakrishnan, your Labour List MP based in the electorate of Maungakeakea. As always, I have some very special guests here in the studio with me today. I've actually got Tracy Huff and Libby Rowe, both from Assistance Dogs New Zealand Trust. And I met both Tracy and Libby earlier this year in March at the New Zealand Top Office Dog Conference. I was incredibly excited to be invited to speak at a conference that had lots of dogs at it. The conference was about the positive effects of having dogs at the workplace. And I was invited to talk also about what the government's doing in the mental health space. And anyone who knows me knows that I have two very beautiful rescue dogs of my own and that I've loved dogs for as long as I can remember. So I'm actually very excited to have both Tracy and Libby here, and also Ryder, who of course you can't see, but we've got an assistance dog in the studio, which is incredibly exciting. So a huge welcome to all three of you. Thanks for coming in. Tracy, would you like to, I'll go to you first and then to you, Libby, and if you'd just like to introduce yourselves a little bit and say a little bit about what Assistance Dogs New Zealand Trust does.
Okay, sure. Hi everybody, I'm Tracy. I'm the trainer for Assistance Dogs New Zealand. We're based in Auckland at the moment, and I've been with the organisation for 6 years. My main role is to train the dogs for Assistance Dogs New Zealand for the majority of disabilities that Assistance Dogs New Zealand Trust do. We're a charitable trust. We have been going since 2008, so 11 years young, and our aim is to enrich the lives of the families out there with disabilities. What else, Liz?
Oh yeah, we are an accredited organisation with Assistance Dogs International. Mm-hmm. And with being a fully accredited member, that actually is recognised for us in New Zealand and gives us public access with our teams to go into places where normally dogs are not able to do.
Right.
So that's very important for us because it enables the teams to experience a wide range of access to different environments with their dog. Mm. As a team.
Yeah.
And, we're a registered charity and don't get any government funding.
Right.
Yeah.
And how long have you been with Assistance Dogs?
I've been nearly 3 years now. Mm-hmm. My role is education manager. And one of the things that Assistance Dogs is looking to do is to have long-term sustainability. So my role primarily is to actually work with the team to gradually develop an education system which can provide training programs for key roles within the organisation. For example, an assistance dog instructor or assistance dog trainer. So if we can develop these programmes, we can train new staff, and long term we'll have longer sustainability as an organisation.
Ah, right. Ah, yes.
Interesting. So, yeah, so that'll be great because retirement for me is probably, you know, coming around the corner, so to speak. So you want to leave it in good hands. And
yes.
So Liz's role is really important to sustain that for us.
Right, yeah. Right. Yes, of course. Now, tell me a little bit about a dog like Ryder. So what kinds of, I guess I'll start maybe with what types of disabilities you train dogs for.
Yep. So basically we train for multiple disabilities. Probably our biggest client base is autism. So we have probably, and autism is a huge spectrum, so it's a very broad spectrum that we train for. We also train for diabetic alert dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So when the clients are going into a hypo, so their blood sugars are dropping, the dog will alert them. We also have cerebral palsy that we train for. What else, Liz?
It's a broad range, really. We try to, for people who approach us to get an assistance dog, we try to train for tasks and disabilities that aren't covered by one of as a primary disability by one of the other organisations. Mm-hmm. So sort of fill in some areas which were not at that stage when Julie Hancock's and Rick Hancock's founded assistance dogs available to people. Mm-hmm. And so if we do get somebody who is applying for a dog with a disability that says for maybe hearing loss as a primary disability, we would then refer them on to hearing dogs.
Right.
Rather, yes. So, but sometimes we have clients that have more than one disability, so we may train a primary disability, say as autism, but there may be a secondary mm-hmm. disability there as well. We might be able to develop tasks to assist with.
Right. And can you tell me a little bit about what that looks like? So you mentioned, Tracy, that autism is a spectrum. So can you tell me a little bit more about how you train dogs and what they would be doing with a person who then gets them and has is on the spectrum?
Sure.
If you could just expand, that's really interesting.
Okay. So basically with autism, you know, you have Asperger's. So you have somebody that's very... can communicate to look at them. You know, autism's one of these quite hidden conditions where to look at somebody you wouldn't know whether they were on the spectrum or whether they had autism or not. To the degree where we have some children that have quite sensory overload, so going out into a mall, swimming pool environment, out there in the public can be overstimulating for them, so therefore what they want to do is obviously get out of that. So the job of the dog is to actually assist with that in a number of ways. We have a children on there where they are connected with the dog, so they actually have a piece of equipment which connects them to the dog, so like a lead around about area of the child. Mm-hmm. So what would happen is you do find that children would want to say, hey, let's get out of a mall, whereas with the dog they actually be happy to sit there and see the world go by because the dog actually takes that away from them. If they do decide to go, the dog acts as an anchor, so keeps them safe. So Ryder, you see Ryder lying in a down position like that. Mm-hmm. So he would go into a down position and the child would probably want to move the dog and he would just lie along the floor like a dead weight, like an anchor. And generally you find what that happens is the parents have got time to actually, if they're talking to somebody or their hands paying for a bill or something like that, it just gives them a delay time to actually then, you know, say, oh goodness, you know, they've moved maybe a few feet away from them, rather than actually trying to juggle holding on to the child. Mm-hmm. And trying to then pay for things or put things in a shopping bag or speak to somebody. So they're trying to juggle all those things, whereas a dog actually allows the child to explore, not be restricted apart from being with the dog. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it works. It's amazing just how the dog actually slows the child down and lets them process things and calms them down.
Right.
I don't know if you've got anything else to add to that with Lib.
No, I mean, just to reiterate what you were saying about safety, because quite often the only way is to hold on to the child by the hand, and sometimes that can be quite difficult, especially as they get a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And you've got the restriction then of always having one of the hands held for obvious safe reasons. And so what having a dog in that sort of role helps to do is for the family and the child to actually experience situations where the hands are free and they can look around and take more of the environment, but in a safe way.
Right.
Because sometimes they might want to run. Mm. And if you're out on the street, they can just run. And it's a serious potential safety hazard.
Sure.
So a dog can actually, through the task it's been trained, resist that and keep the child safe while the parents deal with the situation.
So in that example or that scenario that you've just outlined? So when you've got a young child and the dog is trained to act as an anchor mm-hmm. for that child, how does the dog know when to drop? Like, I'm guessing that these are quite, you know, quite different scenario, very case-by-case sort of scenarios. How do you train, do you then train the dog with that particular child, or how does it work?
Yeah, so basically you heard Liz use the word resist. So when they have a connection and they're sort of like tethered to the dog, we like to use the word connection, the lead will go quite tight. So the dog knows when the lead is at right. that resist, as we call it, their job is to actually hold an anchor position. Once that actually then loosens, so the child stops pulling the dog or mm-hmm. trying to step over a curb to go in front of a car or anything like that, that when that actually then reduces, the dog knows it's done its job. So the child's obviously no longer resisting and trying to get away. They're quite happy to either stand still and wait and process. A lot of the times the kids will sit down and just start touching their dog. So that some ways that is how we teach a resist. Mm. So that now your second part of the question was once the dogs are trained, we have a quite a long waiting list. So we have previously Lib talked about you know, applying for an assistance dog. So once they meet all the criteria and have been interviewed and have an assessment and the right dog comes up for them, then we have a matching. So the instructors and the trainers get together, we look at the environments, we look at what the dogs have been trained for. We train each dog individually, so not all dogs are trained exactly the same way. So Ryder might hear, if he is matched with the client, may need to go on the trampoline. He may need to go swimming. He may need to go to riding for the disabled. He may need a deep pressure skill, which is a calming skill. So when the children have looks like a meltdown, you know, the dog will come down and lie on him and calm them down. So every dog has individual skills that we train for according to that particular client. Mm. So once they do that and they are matched, then we have a client training program which can take anywhere between 10 days to 14 days where the instructor will place the dog and teach. We have a triangle, so we have parent, child and dog, so it's a triangle. So we are teaching the parents or the caregivers to actually then work the dog with the child.
Mm-hmm.
Does
right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. It absolutely does. And if we have some time a bit later on in the program, I'm keen to go back to some other examples of
sure.
what
yeah.
dogs do as well. But how many dogs on average do you have at any given point in time, or does that vary quite a bit?
It does vary. I'm only with the organisation on a part-time basis. So I have anywhere four dogs at one time in training, and those four dogs may be all for autism or they may be for a variety of disabilities. So what happens is we do an assessment on the dog. So during that assessment phase for takes 3 to 4 months depending on the dog and what we're looking for, we generally get an idea, Lib and I get an idea of where that dog's role and training may be channeled. So we might say, look, you know, like we've got Rufus at the moment, autism, let's put him in for autism. Ryder probably won't go for autism. He would be maybe with an older type of person, you know, sort of like a teenager up rather than a young child. Why is that? Because some dogs absolutely love children. So, you know, some kids are very tactile, like a lot of touch, like investigating. Some dogs really enjoy that and take that on board. So that's what you're wanting, a really tolerant, resistant dog. Ryder enjoys touch, like he's loving what Jesse's doing at the moment, but he wouldn't want a child climbing on him or hugging him, constantly. He's a little bit, you know.
So you assess the dogs individually in terms of what their aptitude would be.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well.
Yeah.
And for those who are listening who obviously can't see, Ryla's really just lying on the floor and being petted, and that's it. He's such a good boy.
He is a good boy, yeah. So, so we would have that, and we would do then a 6 month, you know, is formal training. So it would take us six months to.
That was going to be my next question.
To train a dog,
6 months.
Yeah.
And where do you get the dogs from?
Oh, well, I've probably done enough talking, so Lib, join on in.
So we breed all our own dogs.
Right.
And so we have some breeding stock. We also we collect frozen semen and sometimes get some frozen semen from overseas from other registered schools with Assistance Dogs International in order to give a broader range and options of the types of dogs. We breed Labradors mainly, but sometimes some Golden Retrievers or Golden Retriever cross Labradors. And so we usually have one or maybe two litters a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're bred at our with Julie and Rick's place in Perongia, which has a small setup with kennels and what we call the whelping wagon, where the puppies are born and raised for the first 7-8 weeks of their life.
Yeah.
And then from that point, they'll actually transfer into volunteer homes, which we call our puppy raisers, who are marvellous. And thank you if anyone's listening who's a puppy raiser or a volunteer for us. We couldn't do what we do without you guys. And they take this puppy into the home for 12, 14 months sometimes, and raise them with the support of our puppy raising supervisor, Robin.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point from then, when a training slot becomes available with Tracy or Ashley, our other trainer, or myself occasionally, we will then take the puppy off. It's now an adult and start the assessment process that Tracy's actually just talked about. All of our dogs are assessed for health, but also for temperament. So they're all individual like us in ways. They're not like people, obviously, but they do have lend themselves to certain roles, like Tracy was saying, and have different personalities. Some are quite outgoing or have a little bit of a cheeky, mischievous side, and others are very much like laid back and easygoing.
Yep.
Some have higher drive and energy. So these can all be really valuable things that we can build on for the working tasks of the dogs, but it lends itself to doing different types of tasks.
Mm.
But what's really, really important for us is the dogs that we use, and this is why we breed our own from well-known and long-standing lines that have been bred for working with people with disability, is that they're sound temperamentally and physically.
Mm.
Even though they're actually different in the roles that they're going to do, they all have to meet that standard before they can actually enter into becoming and qualifying. So the dogs will qualify as an assistance dog once they meet the criteria that they need to. And then we will look for a match, like Tracy was saying, but then we will, the match will be trained together, and then they become a team. And it's very much a team that they all work together.
Mm. So then,
sorry, I might have got a bit off track there.
No, this is interesting, so please. I have a question, though. So have you ever come across a situation, either one of you, where you have a dog that you've bred who doesn't qualify, either because of temperament or physical, what's required of the dog physically? Have you ever come across that before?
Yeah, we do.
What happens then?
So basically what will happen if it doesn't make the program, we have a couple of options. So we have an option where if it's a dog with a very, very high drive, high use of nose, and we think that it could use for another service dog, particularly in customs, for you know, narcotic
dogs.
Yeah, yeah. Detector dogs, mm-hmm. That we would offer them to them. Mm-hmm. Secondly, wonderful puppy raisers get an option to then keep the dog that they puppy raised for that period of time and adopt it and have it as a family pet. Sometimes due to, you know, circumstances of the puppy raisers, as hard as that decision is, they may choose not to do that. So our third option would be we have a selection process for adoption homes. So that would be just, you know, if you were interested in adopting one of our dogs, ooh, then then, you know, we would interview you, check out your property and make sure that, you know, the dog would have a very, you know, good, happy life with you once it left our organisation. So ethically we're bound to ensure that that dog's placed in the most appropriate place accordingly.
Yep. Good.
Yeah.
You mentioned, Libby, that your dogs are mostly Labradors or sometimes Golden Retrievers.
Or a cross between,
or
the,
cross
two,
between,
yeah,
the two. Is there a reason why they're Labs, largely?
Well, the Labrador generally has been renowned for many years, and if you look at working dogs, a lot of they do a lot of roles with assisting with people with disability and other types of working roles, like you were saying, narcotic dogs as well, a detector dog type of work. One of the considerations is not only the temperament and how they're trained and their ability to focus and different aspects depending on what type of tasks you're going to train the dog, but it's also the physical size. So size can be a factor in some of the roles and what you want them to do. And I think really the Labrador fits the role really well and has been used for many, many years, decades, for different jobs, sort of working with disabilities from, including guide dogs, which is probably a well-known one where you see a lot of Labradors working. So the lines that we breed from are from established lines that have come from generations of working dogs, Labradors that have been working with disability.
Right. So there's probably then something in the genetics of the dog as well, is
yeah,
that?
Absolutely. So it's a combination. It's that nature nurture environment as well. But if you've got, you can sometimes have different lines, which lends itself as if a Labrador, but they can be different depending on what lines they come from. So for the work we want, generally we want a range of type of dogs, but say we want dogs that are steady. You know, both physically and
temperament-wise.
So Labradors tend to, they're wonderful dogs. They do, anyone who knows Labradors knows that they love their food.
Oh, yes.
So one of the things is that while that can be very useful in training as well, we have to obviously manage that because some Labradors can be very keen. They have alarms, clocks in their stomach for dinner time. So that can be a positive, but it can also be a drawback if they're a little bit more emphasis on some labs. They're all foodie, but some are more so, which needs to be managed.
Yes, my Gypsy is definitely in the latter category. She would do anything.
Yes.
Just in the case.
Yes.
She's just started this new funny thing in the last maybe 6 to 8 months where she comes in, like what you said, that's what led to
dinner time.
Yes, it's like she has an alarm clock.
Yeah.
And when it's time for dinner, she now comes and sits either in front of my husband or myself and just, you know, as close as she can get and just stares at us until we feed her. It's quite disconcerting.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Yes, we've all seen that. Yes,
we have indeed.
Now you mentioned a waiting list. How long is your waiting list at the moment?
Oh, it varies. It's probably, I would say, on average, around about approximately five and a half years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right.
Would you say that, Liz?
It does vary, but yeah, it can be.
So if someone wants an assistance dog, they should get in there as soon as they know that they want one?
Yeah, generally we'd like to get the dogs in earlier with the children, particularly with autism. earlier, because then their role, they're going to be in there for a lot longer. So by the time they get to, you know, if you've got them in there at 4 or 5, then, you know, by the time they're 10, they've already learnt some skills. They may be actually then no longer being tethered with the dog. They may be actually holding a little handle. So you're seeing their development. And that's a great thing with assistance dogs. We're not, just because we train them one way, it doesn't necessarily mean that that child and that dog stay there. We'll upskill the child, the parents and the dog as the children develop. So that's right. The great thing that, you know, we're here to empower them. Some children may never ever get that, but there'll be some children there that got their dogs 10 years ago that are now actually, with the parent following behind them, actually walking their dog to the shop to buy their pinky bar and home. So that there is teaching them life skills and getting out into the community as well.
Right. So when someone applies for and gets an assistance dog, is that for the life of the dog?
Yes, it is.
Right. Yeah. And what if that child or that person needs a dog even beyond that? Do they automatically go back on your waiting
list?
Yeah,
sure they do. I mean, that's something that Liz is talking about, sustainability and things like that. We're 10 years young, so we're just starting to find that our dogs that are now coming up for retirement, there will be some clients there that the dog has done what it needed to do, and so they may not get another one, because they're an adult. They're basically have got the skills now to set them aside to progress. It may be health that they no longer can have another dog. And the other thing was, I was going to say, and I've completely forgotten. So I'm sorry, this orange thing looking at me set me off.
The mic only when it comes here. She wasn't talking about me. So do you also then have the flip side scenario where someone's applied for a dog and got a dog, but they no longer need the dog before the dog has, you know, passed away?
We haven't really come across a lot. We've had the very, in 10 years, maybe the odd one that's come through with
that. Right, so that's not common at
all. It's not common. Okay. No, it's not, yeah.
I just want to, in the couple of minutes that we have left, I wanted to highlight the fact that it's your appeal week.
Yes,
it is. In August. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that and how people can help you.
Oh, right. So our annual appeal is happening from August the 5th to the 11th. And we are nationwide, so we'll be South Island. Obviously, we're a very small organisation, so we're going to be limited as to where we're going to be.
To collect,
do you
need people to help collect for you?
Yeah, we do.
How can they contact you if people listening would like to help collect for assistance dogs?
Send out info at?
Yes, well, if you visit our website.
And I will link the website as well too. But it's www.adnztrust.org.nz?
Yes. And if we can link that, email. That would be wonderful. And there's an email there, an info email. And if they were to contact that or ring the 0800 number, we will get back to them, and we'd love to hear from people who are able to help us.
So just for anyone who's listening, the email is info@adnztrust.org.nz. That's info@adnztrust.org.nz. And the phone number is 0800 966 342. 0800 966 342 if you'd like to help during the appeal week.
Yeah.
What other, we've got less than a minute left.
Auckland is a big one. So Orewa, Albany, St Luke's, Takanini, Papakura, Manukau City.
And that's
Botany.
Where you already have people collecting.
Yep.
What colour will they be wearing? Is it blue?
Blue.
So if you see people wearing blue with assistance dogs on them collecting during this time,
Ryder will be there.
Ryder will be there. There you go.
Generally it's do not pat, but for a dollar you can pat a dog.
You can buy a pet, people.
Yeah, buy a pet.
Awesome. Hey, thank you both so much for coming into the studio and telling us a bit more about what you do.
Oh, no. Yeah, we're very passionate about what we do. So 30 minutes has gone very quick. Sorry.
Thanks, indeed. But it's been wonderful having you and Ryder, and all the very best for your
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
Get together next week at 9:05 a.m. or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.